Welcome to the Daily French Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another exciting episode of the Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and I'm joined today by the wise and venerable Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you?
Well, thanks, Nicholas, and yourself?
I'm very well, thank you. And our chief investigative journalist, the tall man with the beard, Mr. Gabriel Krauser, who is back from his sojourn in Mpumalanga and going to tell us all about what happened to him. Gabriel, how are you?
I'm good. How's it to both of you? And an apology to our listeners. I am currently sort of in Sandton, in central Sandton. And so if you hear a bit of construction or car sounds in the background, my apologies for that. We are currently having the IRR car repaired next door at the repair shop. And it's taken a day longer than they said right. It would. But I can't go without the car.
I believe part of the reason that it is being repaired is because someone threw a rock at you, as we discussed on the Tuesday show.
Yes, that is. It is not for any other reason that the car needs to be repaired.
Indeed. So let's get straight into it then. Tell us what happened. You were there in Petre Tief, Makondo, to investigate what? A case about shooting farm workers?
Yes. So there's a double murder trial, murder, kidnapping, assault. And the two deceased are the Tolka brothers, Amos and Senzele, although Amos is otherwise known as Ntlibi, I think. The allegation coming from four witnesses, quoted, summarized by the state in the bail hearings on Tuesday, was that seven people had arrived on Pampunkral Farm outside Petre Tief, otherwise known as Mkondo, and they'd come to seek work. That one of them was assaulted, Mr. Hlatswayo, and then tied to a tree, whereupon the other six left and called in for support. When that support came, it included the Tolka brothers, and at the same time, the farm owners, farm workers, and indunas called in their support group, and then the two groups were sort of stuck on either side of a road, in a sense stuck on side of either side of the fence, where the work seekers and their families and friends had come to try and liberate Mr. Hlatswayo, who had been held hostage and were told to go away. And when they didn't, two of them were shot dead. The version of the accused, five accused, four farmers and a farm manager, is that they at Pampunkral, people had arrived in the morning, were harassing farm workers, telling them to call the farm manager or farm owner. Mr. Potkita arrived and the farm owner, and he was then struck with a blow to the head by a Nobkiri, whereupon the farm workers then detained Mr. Hlatswayo for this attack and called the police. And it is confirmed by the police that they were phoned at this time, around 11 in the morning, and that they were holding Mr. Hlatswayo while they waited for the police to come. But the police didn't come. By an hour or so later, a larger group had arrived, including the Tolka brothers, and they were wanting to get Mr. Hlatswayo released and were angry with the farmers. Mr. Potgieter, in the meanwhile, I think, was taken to hospital. I'm not sure if he was taken right then or later. Certainly he was taken to hospital, where he remained for quite some time for his severe head injury. And then as things heated up, one of the Tolka brothers struck a blow to one of the farmers, Hans Mulman's head, with a steel pipe, which knocked him out. And Mr. Mulman has been in hospital in a condition that renders him incapable of speaking. So I'm not sure how severe it is. I'm not sure if he's in a coma or not, but he's been in a very serious condition for the last 10 days. And he was armed. upon being struck to the ground, the Kolka brother was able to take his gun and then run back to try and get to the safety of the bucky that he had and get in or behind that bucky in order to shoot the farmers from behind the bucky so that he would be protected from being shot back at. But he was shooting while he was running and so accidentally struck his own brother, who then died. So that's how the one Kolka brother died. And then himself was shot allegedly by Ottard Klinger in self-defense while he was being shot at. So those are the two versions. And
and they're completely different from each other, really. I mean, in some of the key facts there.
They are day and night, yes. So, yeah, I went to the court to hear those versions play out, and in particular to hear the versions of the accused are in the bail hearing, they're not cross-examined. They don't go into the witness stand and face cross-examination. Basically, the affidavits are read into the record, and the state, however, does have to produce – well, the state produced their investigating officer, warrant officer David Vukile, and he – is cross-examined because one of the arguments that the defense can make is that if the state's case is weak, then you should release the accused on bail. You can still go forward with the case if the state prefers to do so, if it thinks later evidence will surface, but a bail application is an urgent application. If the state's case is at the moment weak, then that's a reason for them to get bail. Other reasons that they gave is that they're not a flight risk, that's common cause, that they're trying to harvest their soya, for example, right now. A lot of farm owners involved, four of them, without them and the farm manager, operations stall, which could render the year's crop either less profitable, not profitable or at all, or a dead loss. Other such concerns are raised, of course, in the bail hearing. But the state's, the strength or weakness of the state's case, I think, was the most interesting from a public perspective in that cross-examination. And it was a very, it was a difficult thing to sit and watch. The gallery was occupied by a self-proclaimed EFF member of parliament. I didn't manage to get his name. There were some people with ANC paraphernalia, three ANC leaders there. And during the break before the warrant officer came to testify for the state, they were taking photographs of the accused and of the courtroom. The court official came in to say, you can't do that. Permission's only been given for the media to do that. You're not media representatives. On the list, everyone has to give a justification for why they're coming to court. And your justification has been that you're community leaders. And so the court has given specific instructions about who is and who isn't allowed to take photographs. They then shouted at her and told her not to speak to them as children. That was one of the first sort of heated exchanges. There was another heated exchange outside to do with a separate rape case where there was some toy-toying in the sort of courthouse. Of course, outside of the court, there was flashbangs and rocks being thrown and bricks being thrown and loudspeakers blaring speeches and music the whole day through. So it was a bustling and exciting environment to try and soberly assess the merits of the case. The final sort of theatrical frame of reference that I think people should be aware of is that in the course of the warrant officer giving his testimony, I noticed that he was someone was drawing attention to himself by clicking his pen against his forehead and then holding up a board with paper on it that he'd written messages on to show to the warrant officer while he was testifying across the courtroom. And this person was sort of seated behind the podium of the state's attorney, of the state's counsel, sorry, an advocate, and so was out of the view of the magistrate, Magistrate Van Cormon. So he couldn't be seen by the magistrate, and he couldn't really be seen by the defense because he's sort of to the little bit behind the defense and the other way from the witness. But he could be seen by the gallery, by people like me. I was the only media guy at the time still there. And I assumed that you're allowed to do this because he kept doing it and writing more messages and holding them up for the investigating officer to see while he's giving his testimony what to say. When the defense finally noticed this an hour later, they drew attention to the court that this is taking place. And suddenly the papers were concealed and the board was put flat. And they said, no, this is just notes. And then they said, no, we definitely saw this. If you want to deny that this happened, you're going to make this an even more serious matter. Then they said, no. We're trying to help the investigating officer out. This guy should be seated next to him. Then they all started speaking Latin, and I couldn't really understand, but I did court terminology. but I did speak to a legal expert who said that this is extremely worrying, and that in the usual course of things, you would throw a witness's testimony out if it was being tampered with literally while he's sitting in the box. The defense said that they were flabbergasted at the behavior. An adjournment was called, and when we came back, it was that stopped. So that was a sort of kind of theatrical fandango, which gave one the sense that the rules that things were irregular.
Right. So I have two questions before we go to Terrence's take on this, and before we finish up. One, do we know who the person who was giving the notes was?
He's a police officer.
Okay, he is a police officer. And the second question is, any idea what was being written on those notes specifically?
I tried to see. I couldn't make out the words themselves because when he was writing them, I'd sort of have to look at a funny angle. And when he turned them up straight, it was facing away from me.
Okay, so that's very worrying behavior by the police. Anything you want to add before I ask Terrence's view?
Yeah, so I just want to add that what the investigating officer said was extremely worrying. He summarized the state's case as I've just described it about these four innocents and unarmed work seekers being viciously murdered. Sorry, these seven people going, one being detained, then them getting more people, and then two being viciously murdered. This was hard to hear. I mean, it's a devastating account. If that's what happened, it's heinous. Cruel and unusual crime. The defense challenged it by asking the state whether any of these witnesses could explain how Mr. Potgieter or Mr. Mulman or one of the other farmers who was seriously injured were injured. These witnesses were there, and there were these two groups, and they were antagonistic. How did the one group get injured? There was no explanation of that. The second thing that they challenged them on is why did these witnesses not call the police to get assistance in helping out with the liberation of Mr. Slachwayo if they believed that he was innocently being detained, illegally being detained, given that the police are about 5-10 minutes away and the families that had to come from further? And there was no explanation of that either. Those were the two chief challenges, namely that the story might be inconsistent in itself, and that the story doesn't take into account material and objective uncontested facts, namely that three of the farmers were injured. And by the way, all of the witnesses and the accused agree that after the shots were fired, there was no more violence. Things cooled down and everyone stayed put basically for 20 minutes until the police finally did arrive. This is about 2 hours after they were initially called, but 20 minutes after the shots were fired. So those injuries couldn't have been sustained after the shots. If they had been sustained before the shots, it would undermine the state's case and serve the accused case that the shootings took place in self-defense.
Interesting. So there's a hell of a lot of detail in that story. I think that that is a bit going to be difficult to unpack in the time that we have. But Terrence, it seems like there's a number of issues here. And one of them is that there was something like a labor dispute in the sense that there was pressure because of unemployment, and that appears to have led to a confrontation of some kind, which both versions seem to agree on. And then what followed from there was escalation. And the other thing, of course, is that throughout the police are unreliable or absent, not showing up to mediate things and prevent things from getting out of control. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, look, that's the kernel here, I think, from a public policy perspective, that the state agency is meant to mediate this sort of thing, just don't function properly. You know, Gabriel mentioned a 2 hour wait. You know, this is where people have been seriously injured. It's not that's a very worrying state of affairs. You know, something that has been kind of suggested that this may have something to do with a sort of work seeker scam. People are encouraged to go to this farm because supposedly there's work there, and supposedly the funds have been made available. I don't have the full facts, but that idea was put to me. Apparently, it's been happening. It's been happening more and more on farms, and I think some urban businesses as well. It's vaguely known to a lot of people that the government has given money for COVID, and your leader or broker or whatever will come and say, well, you know, this business has got 5 million rand, so you're entitled to go there and get a job. Is it possible that something like this could have been at play? But you know, obviously we have to wait and see what emerges in court. As Gabriel says, it seems to be a very complicated situation. Unfortunately, I think this has also been hijacked by various vested interests who are invested in getting. In getting people angry and driving particular narratives. I've been quite disappointed with some of the reporting that I've seen in much of the media, which seems to also be committed to a sort of good versus evil portrait. And I think you know what Gabriel said about the conduct of the police officers in the court is mind blowing. And I think that irrespective of the facts or the outcome of this case, that is something that should have got a great deal more attention.
Right. So there's one more thing that I think we definitely need to cover before we move on. And that is, of course, the very nasty racial edge that this whole thing has taken on. So, of course, in the one version of the story, this is essentially a labor dispute that escalates out of control. And in the other version of the story, this is a brutal killing of unarmed black men by white farmers.
And a black farm worker.
Who's
mentally corrupt or something.
Right, right. So the idea here is that there needs to be proper justice and vengeance, and that seems to be what the ANC is pushing. And I presume that led in part to the attack on you, Gabriel, is that the ANC and the EFF are encouraging basically people saying, look, the whites are killing us, that kind of thing. You need to go out and commit violence. Can you talk a little bit about this racial aspect thing that's going on? How much of it is manufactured? Is it like widespread? What's the story here?
Yeah, I mean, I must say, to its credit, both ANC and EFF leaders who were speaking through the microphone at times called for peace and to calm down and to collaborate with the police. Also, at times, they sang warlike songs and made very aggressive comments about white people, about farmers, very antagonistic in that regard. It's like push-pull. The racial edge is clear. The police themselves, the warrant officer who testified, said one of the reasons you should deny these people bail is that if you let them out, there will be even more anti-white violence. We've already had reports of anti-white violence, and there will be more if you let them out, because the people believe, the warrant officer said, I've been going up and down everywhere investigating it, and everyone I speak to says, no, there's a problem with white people here. You can't let these ones out. You must put more white people in jail. And he said that there are more arrests to be expected, and that if you let these guys out, there'll be more anti-white violence. So that's coming from the investigating officer, the chief investigating officer in this case. That's definitely also my experience. When I was attacked, the words Umlungu were being yelled at me, together with other phrases. All of the victims of car attacks that I'm aware of were white. In the story that I filed, I mentioned four cases where people had their cars bashed in. I've had reports from a business colleague of a fifth person whose car was bashed in the same area on the same day, who actually, they managed to throw enough rocks through that they smashed the window and then got another rock through that struck him a blow to the head. And he managed to get away. But later I think, lost consciousness and had to be hospitalized. So it was very serious. Also, a man was stabbed in the total garage where I was attacked, and that person is, according to the police, still in hospital. I don't know the race of that person. And I think it's important to say that once you're outside of your car, you're not just identified by your looks. You are also easily identified by what you're saying or what you're not saying. And if someone is not going along with the narrative, black or white, they can be challenged. And this was made clear in court and outside of court. It was also made clear at the funeral, which I attended, of the Tolka brothers, which was an elaborate affair sponsored by the municipality, huge gazebos, municipal trucks going up and down many kilometers of dirt road to splash water so that there wouldn't be dust, porta potties, food for everyone, and so on. Very beautiful coffins, very beautiful speeches, some of them especially coming from the religious leaders, especially coming from the traditional leaders. But some of the political leaders that spoke said that if you're a black person and you work for white farmers, you are impimpi. You are a spy of the apartheid regime. And this is something that the traditional leaders especially expressed to me is a message that they desperately want to put away. But it's part of the narrative. It's part of the politics on the scene in Piet Retief.
Interesting. So that's quite interesting that the traditional leaders are not on side here with the politicians, which I think is a good thing for the stability of that community. But very worrying stuff indeed.
I worry for their safety. Yes.
Yeah. No. Definitely. That I suspect this is not the end of potential violence there.
Especially not just to put a final point on it. The bail hearing is not concluded. The state council had other appointments, so it'll have to come back next week. And I mean, whether it's speaking to the court security who don't have guns, or to sort of low level workers at petrol stations and at funeral parlors and the like, they're terrified of what will happen if bail is granted.
Right.
Because they think, you know, to use an American phrase, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Indeed. So as you mentioned, Terrence, I think one of the worst aspects of this has been how incredibly poorly the story has been covered by most of the media. I believe that only the state's case was basically reported in the media. The defense was given almost no detail at all. And Gabriel can correct me if I'm wrong on that, but also the details of the case, the racial language, the violence against ordinary white people there, the police's activities in the court, apart from the Daily Friend, I don't think anyone has reported that. What's your thoughts, Terrence?
I think you're quite right, and I think that this is a situation where, at the very least, you need nuance. I think nuance in itself challenges dogmatic narratives. And while there may be some in the journalistic community who are simply, you know, working off very limited information that's being transmitted out, anybody who's been there, I think, should make a point of trying to understand the different perspectives. I think that would simply be a matter of professional responsibility, and it's concerning if it's not being done. Certainly, my experience may well be incomplete, is that there is a very simplistic, one-sided, and very charged narrative being created and put forward.
Definitely. If I can follow up on that, Nick. Sorry, sure. I know we're running on time here. In the Afrikaans media, that hasn't been the case. Rapport, the cover page of its weekly issue on Sunday, was on this case, and they did present both sides, and they did present nuance. I would further add that it's there are some local radio stations and papers that have been trying. I think it's on the national news that we've really been seeing this one-sided thing. Right.
Papers and websites and stuff. Okay, yeah, no, I think that's a very important TV. Distinction. Yeah,
and so as not to fall prey to the same mistake. You know, I should say one of the reasons that people in the area are so charged against Pampoen Kraal farmers is the allegation that last year or that recently several cows belonging to members who were involved with this group, with this incident, that a number of cows had been poisoned to death. And it does seem plausible on the face of it. The story is that there's people in the homesteads, you might call them labor tenants, although not in the legal sense, who are running cattle, and then there's disagreement between the farmers and them about what the carrying capacity of the land is, and so what they're allowed. And it is the landowner's duty by law to enforce the laws on not exceeding carrying capacity of the land. Now the proper way to do this is usually to get an order from the sheriff to impound the cattle. This can take years, but the allegation is that that was circumvented. The law was taken into their hands, and some of the cows were poisoned. There's also it is a fact that in August last year, two people died in the vicinity of this farm that was covered by special assignment. Again, in a one-sided fashion, they didn't manage to get a story out of the farmers, although they tried. That case is not even pending. There's no open investigation. There's no open allegation from the state side that the farmers were responsible for those murders, which suggests to me that there isn't good evidence to support this allegation. But it is widely believed by the community that both the cows were killed and that there were previous deaths the farmers were responsible for.
So that would suggest why this escalated so quickly and in such a violent way. Is that there's already this underlying narrative about how these particular guys are bad hombres, to use a line from President Trump. Okay.
Complicated, and that all needs to be looked further into, and that is what we're doing.
Exactly. And I think we won't do another topic today because we are running a bit late now. But that for me is once again the key here is we've got very different stories. We've got conflicting evidence. We've got a complicated case that needs to be unpacked and thought through in a rational and sober way. And so what we don't need are politicians there with racial invective and agitation. What we don't need is police who appear to not be doing their job. I mean, as you say, those previous murders, there's no case open for them. So, of course, people are just going to believe crazy things if there's literally no sort of investigation going on into them, the police not showing up on time, the police not de-escalating the situation, and from the sounds of it, the police acting poorly in the courtroom, which is yet another level above in terms of
the police acting poorly. I mean, sorry to jump in here.
In your case,
told me to go where I went, where I was attacked with those rocks thrown at the car. I was following the police's instructions of where to go.
And
I was following it very directly. They said, go to the Total Garage. Everyone else was also following it indirectly in the sense that the police had put out the route that you're supposed to go. You're not supposed to go here. You're supposed to go there. And the police were great. The first half of the day on Monday was hectic. I mean, there were thousands of protesters and there were lots of rocks being thrown and I didn't see anyone. There was none of this like shooting rubber bullets into someone's face 2 meters away. The police were disciplined and they followed procedure for the first half of the day. And then by 2 o'clock, the police for the most part melted away, but the protesters were still there. And the protesters retreated from the barbed wire fence in large part 4 blocks down to the Total Garage. And that wasn't addressed. Even when a man had been stabbed, the police didn't go to then secure the area. When rocks were being thrown through cars, I mean, that took place at least for an hour, maybe an hour and a half, maybe two. People were still coming into the police station suffering this, and no one thought to go out and investigate the matter. It was kind of tacitly accepted by everyone that the point of going to the police station to report this crime is to get a case number so that the insurance company will reimburse you for the damage, so that the police can go and stop this thing from continuing to happen, which is absurd.
Right, but this is what this version is even more worrying because, as you say, the police were capable of acting correctly in the first half of the day and then just stopped. Anyway, any final thoughts, Terrence, before we wrap up in the last 20 seconds or so here?
No, but, you know, I really do wish that those with influence would step back and think very carefully about the consequences of inflaming situations which are fraught with potential for inflammation.
Indeed.
nothing good at all can come out of this. If an injustice has been done in a constitutional democracy, let that be punished through the appropriate channels.
Right. And indeed, if the state's case turns out to be more or less accurate, all of the actions by protesters and politicians here, I think, have done nothing but undermine the thoroughness and goodness of that case. So it's in everyone's interest to step back from this. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today. I hope that you found the show interesting and enlightening. Thank you, Gabriel, for coming on today. It was good to hear from the horse's mouth, so to speak, what exactly is going on in the on the edges of South Africa. And yeah, we'll see you next week. Tonight we've got a live stream with me and Terence and Gabriel again. We're going to be talking about expropriation and who fits the bill for it. But you'll find out more about that tonight at 7. Anyway, thank you very much and have a wonderful weekend, everyone.